We've had a few talks already about non-standard Higgs decays. I'm going to be talking about a sort of non-standard way of searching for these. So it occurred to me that a lot of you may have never come across diffractive Higgs production before, so I'm going to give a brief introduction to central exclusive production, which is the way that we're going to look for it, and the FP420 project, which will be needed in order to make full use of this process. Then I had to make a decision on what to talk about, so at the end I'm going to talk about Higgs to 4 tau, because it seems to be quite a common theme to this workshop. There's an example analysis using central exclusive production in FP420. And then in the middle I'm just going to mention these things which are causing a bit of concern for us at the moment in terms of using this type of physics at high luminosity. So central exclusive production is basically this process shown here in the top left. It's quite interesting. During the interaction, the two protons which interact produce some sort of hard scatter, which is shown a bit suggestively here as a gluon going through a top quadrant to a Higgs boson. But during the interaction, the protons remain intact. And this is achieved by a colour screening gluon also being exchanged between the two protons. So the final state is quite interesting. It consists of just two forward protons and a central Higgs Higgs, which can decay in any way that you choose it to. The protons lose about 1% of the momentum during the interaction, so what we're looking for is a predominantly light Higgs here, and I'll get onto that in a minute. But very importantly, they scatter through small angles, typically almost zero angle, and that means that they're not going to be detected by the Atlas CMS detectors that we are currently building at the LHC. And as I've said, all the momentum lost during the interaction goes into the production of the central system. So there's a few things that that it turns out that this central system has to obey. The first is that it clearly has to be colour neutral. Otherwise, if you're taking colour from one of these two protons, they break up and can't do that because they're intact. The second thing is that it's produced in a JZ0 state. And this is really only true for zero angle scattering, but because they scatter through very small angles, it's predominantly true all of the time. So if you produce a resonance such that the Higgs, it has to be have these quantum numbers in it's being produced. And that means that regardless of the decay channel, you've already got a quantum Miller measurement at the LHC. This is sort of the era of linear collider physics, but at the LHC. And one particularly interesting thing is that diquark backgrounds are suppressed due to this JZ0 rule. And this was originally one of the primary motivations for even thinking about doing this, because you might be able to look for, say, Higgs to BB bar, which you can't usually do in this type of gluon fusion because of the large QCD background. So a couple of things about central exclusive production that are interesting is the kinematics. So if you do find a way of tagging these outgoing protons and measuring their momentum accurately, then just from four momentum conservation, you can reconstruct the mass and rapidity of the central system using these simple formulas here, where these C1 and C2s are just the fractional longitudinal momentum losses of each proton during the interaction. So if you can measure the longitudinal momentum of each outgoing proton, then you've got the mass and rapidity straight away. And that gives you a handle on your central system. More importantly, actually, this is a mass measurement of any resonance, regardless of how it chooses to decay. It doesn't depend on the jet energy resolution for Higgs to BB bar, and it doesn't depend on any amount of missing energy. This is usually, originally was done for Higgs to WW star, where you might have one of the Ws decaying leptonically, but also it doesn't matter for this one, this Higgs to 4 tau, in which you're always going to have at least four neutrinos. So the catch is, of course, that I've already said this, but we can't actually measure these outgoing protons because they scatter through small angles and pretty much carry straight on down the beam pipe. The only way to measure these protons is to install new detectors 420 metres or about 220 metres from the interaction points. You could have also put some in at about 310, but I think that idea has gone out the window now. So what happens is that the protons travel. If you look in this picture at the bottom here, the protons leave the interaction point, and this dotted line here is where the beam goes. But these protons that have interacted don't have enough momentum to stay in the same trajectory as the beam. So they bent slowly out of the beam, and depending on the momentum loss, this black line here is a 1.5% momentum loss, then you get bent out of the beam much more than, say, 0.2% momentum loss. And the exact acceptance depends on how close you can get your detector to the beam. But you can't get it right up next to the beam, otherwise you'll start doing what CDF did once, and that's actually put your detectors into the beam, and that causes all sorts of problems. The upper acceptance is governed by the beam pipe. You'll crash into the beam pipe if you lose too much momentum before you get to your detector.
So is that one bouncing off the beam pipe?
No, this is sort of a speed of limit. It's supposed to be just avoids the beam pipe in this picture. So once you've got the acceptances and fractional momentum losses, then you can construct your what mass ranges you can cover. So we'll focus on this picture on the top left up here. This is the acceptance, mass acceptance of the central system if both protons are tagged at 420 metres from the interaction point. Remember I said you could have detectors at 220 metres, and from asymmetric tagging you get some coverage as well in the low mass region. But from the kind of models we've been talking about today, the sub-100 GeV Higgs boson searches, you can see that you can get a large acceptance by depending exactly on how close you get your detectors to the beam. I think the sort of nominal lower limit is 3 millimetres, which is this curve that applies over the top. However, there might be some halo-type backgrounds up to about 4 millimetres, so exactly how close we can get still needs to be demonstrated. So you can see pretty good coverage, actually, of a large region of masses where you might want to look for the Higgs. So pick your favourite Higgs model and insert it into the calculation to see what you can do. So I'm going to have to say a few words on what exactly these four detectors are made of, because they'll become very important later on. So the idea is that we're going to install this thing called FB420 on either side of the interaction point to ASP and or CMS. Each side has two stations which are 8 metres apart, which can both measure the position of the proton from the beam. And the position of the proton from the beam basically gives you your fractional momentum loss measurement. The actual position is measured by 3D silicon detectors, which are rigidly fixed to the beam pipe, and then the whole beam is moved closer to where the actual beam is once it's stable. And this is the Hamburg pipe mechanism, which has been demonstrated here. The position of the proton within the station is measured very accurately by the 3D silicon, but the overall position of the proton with respect to the beam requires us to know where our stations are with respect to the beam, and that's is found by these beam positioning monitors attached to the station. And we've got an overall sort of aiming for this 50 micron measurement, and that will dominate our fractional momentum loss uncertainty. And finally, we've got these things called fast timing detectors, which basically are Cherenkov-based and measure the arrival of each proton to an accuracy of 10 picoseconds. So they're the important bits. And on the next page, I've just got a sort of layout. This is a normal beam pipe here, and this would be the same here, except in this schematic we've ripped it out and put in FB420. The protons come down here, they're gradually bent out of the beam, and this is a pocket. Come through a small thin window here. The position is measured with respect to the beam, go out of this pocket, into another pocket, this is of course just in one station here, and enter the fast timing detectors where we measure the time of arrival of each proton. Then it does it all again, I think, a little bit further down here. And that gives us the two measurements of the position, possibly an angular measurement, we'll see. And these are the BPMs that I've talked about. The important bits are the resolution of this silicon measurement and the resolution of the time of flight. The accuracy to which you can measure the four protons determines the accuracy that you can measure your Higgs mass to. And these plots, which aren't great and are currently being changed, show us the mass resolution of the Higgs boson. This purple line is the minimum that you can get to due to the primary momentum spread in the beam at the LHC. It's about 0.77 GeV. You can't do better than this purple line. This red and green line are basically what happens when you have realistic uncertainties and distances measured from the beam using the silicon and the BPMs. And this is what we're basically going to aim for, this line here. These lines up here, these go up because for some reason they include 220 meter information. I don't know why, they should be dropping here. These are when you try and take into account angular measurements to reconstruct the Higgs mass properly, completely. Well, these things can be very badly known, and you can get the mass without using the PT information. So we really should be aiming towards this line here, but ignore these ones over the top. And the important point is that means that you can measure, say, a 90 GeV Higgs here to about to an accuracy of 2.3 GeV. And this is sort of like really, really precision physics at the LHC. And up to 120 GeV, which is more standard made, more normal standard model searches, a 2 GeV measurement. So really, really good precision on these central masses if we can use central exclusive production. Okay, so far it really looks great. We just stick in these four proton detectors, make these Higgses to sort of a good 1.5% accuracy. The problem is that we have really, really low cross sections. Typically, we're in the range of 1 to 20, should be femtobarns, obviously not inverse femtobarns there, so that's luminosity. But here you see this is a standard model cross section. This red line is sort of the default here, and you can see that we're, for say, 120 GeV standard model, you're looking at about 3 femtobarns cross section. This means two things. One is that you have to do this at high luminosities, and the second thing is that you really need good trigger efficiencies to measure fairly low PT objects. I mean, this is a 100 GeV system decaying to 2-4 particles, so you need some good trigger efficiencies there. One thing that I haven't written on this slide but is quite interesting is this spread in predictions just from different PDFs, and this should be seen as a general theoretical uncertainty on central exclusive predictions.
So what do you mean by trigger efficiencies at low PT? Are you trying to also measure the decay products of the Higgs, or are you just going to look for the recoiling protons?
So we get the masses and all that information from the four detectors, but in order to suppress backgrounds, then we need to measure the central system and project on any differences in topology between that and the background. The other thing is that, and I'll get onto this in the next slide, is these trigger efficiencies, why we have a problem with them, right? So do you want to answer that trigger efficiency one?
So you are going to correlate this with the event in the central detector?
Yeah, because these two things will be, the reason why we have to do that will be sort of clear when I discuss this one, and also on the next slide for the trigger, hopefully. If it's not, you can ask again. Again, a typo, but it turns out that you can't trigger at level 1 on forward proton detectors at 420 meters. And this is because the speed of light is too slow for the information to get back in time for the level 1 trigger decision, which at Atlas is 2.5 microseconds, at CMS is 3.5 microseconds. If you could increase the latency of the level 1 decision at Atlas or CMS, push it up to about 4.5 microseconds, then the information will arrive in time. And that, of course, will give us a really, really good trigger. Then you'd have 2-4 protons at 420 meters plus something maybe slightly interesting in the central detector. But unfortunately, you can't do so. At level 2, you can. You can put these things in to substantially reduce your rate. And that's sort of the strategy that's been that's currently being investigated, whether we can raise some level 1 thresholds. Jet thresholds. Although the rate goes up, you'll be able to reject them a lot at level 2. So you have to trigger on central detector quantities in order to keep these events. Lepton triggers are the easiest because they typically have lower thresholds than PT. I mean, I think that the lowest threshold for a muon, for example, is 6 GeV at Atlas, but that's really a low luminosity threshold for a single muon. Jets are very hard to trigger on. Standard triggers always have high thresholds. I think the lowest one's about 180 GeV, and that's at low luminosity at Atlas. So you really have to come up with some good, interesting ways. If your Higgs boson is going to decay to jets, you're going to need some very clever way of keeping these. And there's been some work done on this. So for example, if it's B jets, you can trigger on low PT muons. If you remember, the four protons and the Higgs were separated by, were not colour connected anyway. And so therefore you could have a rapidity gap vetoes in forward regions to keep them. But again, that's a low luminosity one because any gap would be filled in due to pileup at higher luminosities. As I said, none of these are that successful at high luminosity in terms of jets. And so if you're wanting to search for Higgs to some sort of jet-like object, then you're going to have to work very hard to keep these events. So I said I'd talk about luminosity-dependent backgrounds, and that's what we call overlap backgrounds. And I'll try and go through this quick so we can get on to the Higgs to Fortan. These backgrounds occur when you have a coincidence between more than one interaction at the in one bunch crossing at the LHC. And these just add up to produce something that looks like the system that you're interested in. For example, this one at the top here is the largest rate, which we call in this notation with lots of brackets around to indicate that this proton comes from a different event to this hard scatter, which also comes from a different event from another proton. That's just shown in A at the top here. This is a hard scatter producing maybe jets. This is a proton from one interaction, a proton from another interaction. And this can mimic this, this mimics our signal. And if all you were going to do was say that we wanted a hard scatter and two forward protons, then what you find is that every luminosity above about 10 to the 33, which is what you need to be, because you've got low cross-sections, then the overlap background is many orders of magnitude larger than the signal. And I'll show that in a couple of slides. I'll skip that, it's not important. So, of course, that's not what we only do. We don't just like say we want two forward protons and some sort of hard scatter in the central system. We use time of flight rejection. So if you remember, I said that there were these time of flight measurements in FP420, which could measure a proton time of flight to 10 picoseconds. There's a reference clock as well, because you've got to have 10 picoseconds with respect to something. So that's a reference timing is going to be, is assumed to be about 5 picoseconds. So this dominates the uncertainty. So if what you do is you say, well, I've got one proton here, arrived in a certain time, and another proton here, then by the difference in the time of flight, if you know the optics while at the LHC, then you can basically work out where the Z vertex was, assuming that they came from the same interaction. So if you do, then, and you say, take 10 picoseconds, stick it into there, then you find that the accuracy of the vertex measurement should be 2.1 millimeters. And you can correlate with that with something in the central detector that you're interested in. Maybe it's a muon, maybe it's a pair of jet vertices. So basically what you do is you just say you require them to basically be close together, these two vertex measurements, and you can get a rejection on this overlap background, a factor of about 20, whilst keeping 95% of the signal. The thing is that if you could improve this timing to say 2 picoseconds, then the rejection factor would increase to 100. And every time, you'll see later, you need a lot of ways of beating down these types of backgrounds. So that's one way to maybe, and this is 10 picoseconds is considered to be state of the art at the moment. So getting to 2 picoseconds is not only going to involve some sort of major redesign, but also you're going to need a redesigned reference clock. So whether that can be done, I don't know, but you're going to see that it'd be nice if you could do it. The other thing that you could do is maybe time things that are happening in the central detector, putting some timing, whether that's feasible or not, I don't know. But if you did that, then you could actually compare the absolute times to each other and get a larger rejection factor as well.
Why do you need the time of the central? Don't you just need the position of the vertex?
Yes, absolutely, for that way of doing it. But you could compare, say, for example, if you knew how long it took the path length to the forward proton, you could compare each time. And if you look at this picture here.
But I mean, at that point, if you do something in the central, you really have something hard in the central part.
Yeah. Okay.
You pick out what the vertex was, and then you just need accuracy to that vertex.
Yes, and that gives you your rejection factor of 20. But if you've got timing on the central system as well, then if you see this particular one here, right, this is where you get gains on this type of background. So you have a central system produced, say, here, which is a line between you and me now. It might be a bit parallax for some people here, but it'd be interesting. You say that you have a proton here and a proton here that go out that way, right, or that way, in fact. Then what you do is that the difference in time of flight then will give you the vertex location here, right? But if you were here, they give you the difference in the vertex location here. The only rejection you get is when they're offset with respect to not evenly symmetric about that middle point. If you could measure the central time as well, then you would compare this time to this one, and then this time to this one. So you would have two timing measurements instead of one. So you would actually require them to lie on top of each other. All of the vertices to lie on top of each other, rather than them. It could be 5 centimeters apart. But as long as they were on either side, then your time of flight wouldn't. You wouldn't know.
And that 20 is for design and
the
rest of it? Doesn't it get more difficult with more vertices?
With this?
Yeah.
That just basically says that we've got 2 forward protons,
yeah.
And we've got a, and that gives us a vertex. As you go up in luminosity, you might have more than 1 forward proton in each detector, which then you, any combination of vertices, if it matches up with your central one, would be that. But you assume that the assumption going into this is that maybe it's a poor one, is that you've got one hard event in the central system, not many.
I see. So there's some criteria on which vertex to choose.
Exactly. Yeah. But possibly something that
hard.
Yeah. You have to major mind. So something like that. Okay, so the reason why you would maybe want to improve all of this is because these backgrounds are huge, right? This plot on the top left here shows you, this red line here is just dye-jet production at the LHC. And this is about over 10 to the 10 femtobarns, right? So if you were looking for Higgs to jets, then this is 10 orders of magnitude larger than your signal. Requiring 2 forward protons gives you this curve here, okay? So the reason why you increase with luminosity is because what you're essentially asking for is a probability, given a number of interactions in a bunch crossing, that you can get 2 forward protons and a hard scatter. So obviously if you have more interactions in the bunch crossing, as happens at high luminosity, you've got a bigger probability. You can still see that, say, even at low luminosity here, where you might be wanting to do something, this is 10 to the 8 now, still 8 orders of magnitude larger than the signal. Of course, you're probably looking for Higgs to VB bar, so there's some B-jet rejection, bring it down again. You can see they're absolutely massive. This green curve here is that factor of 20 rejection. So if you get a factor of 100, then you just bring it down a little bit more, and you'll see later on the effects and significances of that Higgs to 4 tau scenario. So it turns out that these overlap backgrounds in almost all analyses that we're doing now looking for scalar Higgs, these overlap backgrounds become dominant at high luminosity. At low luminosity, they're not as important as maybe other backgrounds, but if we want to even, when we've got these small cross-sections, if we want to work at high luminosity, we're going to have to work out how ways to beat this down. We've got a few at the moment, but if there's any more, then that'd be great. But we don't have them. So let's move on to the final bit now, which is an example analysis done in central exclusive production, which is just this Higgs to 2 pseudoscalars to 4 tau in the NMSSM. So you've got at least 4 neutrinos in the final state, which means that if you're going to do this with a standard search, then you find the mass of the Higgs quite hard to extract because you've got a lot of missing energy. As you probably trigger on one of the leptons, that would be 5 neutrinos, and it just gets worse and worse. However, of course, we've got mass information from the 4 protons to an accuracy of what, a couple of GeV. This is really the reason why you would think about doing anything in the central exclusive production, is the mass measurement. So we chose a point in MSSM parameter space which resulted in these parameters here. The Higgs mass of about 93 GeV, an A mass of less than 10 GeV, and high branching ratios of Higgs to 2 pseudoscalars. And then the pseudoscalars to tau plus tau minus. It should, there's various reasons which, if anyone's interested in, can ask Jack, who will know better than me, as to why these types of scenarios where you have light pseudoscalars and is in fact, you know, a quite natural solution in the NMSS now. I'll leave that up to the experts rather than me trying to give a hazy recap of that. So if you stick all of this into the machinery which is used to calculate the cross sections, you get for this Higgs to 4 tau just under 5 femtobarns. So again, it's a high luminosity study above 10 to the 33. Here's a slide on backgrounds, and the thing to take out of this is that the top three are all dye jets. It's where basically we've got some sort of jet production at the LHC, which mimics our signal. These two have forward protons naturally in the event themselves, and this is the overlap event here, just dye jet production with 2 forward protons simulated with Pythia. I'm going to ignore the sort of purpose of today's discussion because I've obviously focused on the overlap backgrounds, so I'll continue down that line. We also check QED backgrounds, which produce 2-4 protons with 4 tau and 2 tau 2 leptons, and we found these to be negligible, quite far up the analysis chain. So, the analysis that we ended up doing, though we didn't start out doing it this way, ended up being a track-based analysis. And what I mean by that is that with only one exception, we used about 7 or 8 different variables, cuts, in the analysis, and only one of them used the calorimeters. Everything else used the inner detector. And the reason why we can get away with that is because, like I said, we don't need to measure the mass in the central system. We've got that from the 4 detectors. So we've already got quite a lot of neutrinos taking away energy, so if we just throw away all the neutrons as well, we haven't really lost that much. The benefit, of course, is that tracks can be associated with specific vertices and a specific interaction. This reduces the effect of pyrup as you go higher and higher up in luminosity. And that's, we eventually changed this. We started off, of course, using a standard calorimeter type analysis, but we found out that it didn't work. The reason why it doesn't work, of course, is that the hadronic part of the tau decay is 4 taus adding up to a 100 GeV, it's very low in energy. And we trigger on a low transverse momentum muon, thereby skipping all the nastiness about how hard it is to trigger on jets. And we chose this one trigger, just a muon trigger, though I will show you, I will explain that since then there has been a sort of dedicated trigger study done in this area which improves things. So we're just triggering a low PT muon. We start off with a 10 GeV trigger and then we move to a 15 GeV trigger as well. So the first thing that we just decided to do was say that, well, we've triggered on the muon, 10 GeV, we've got that vertex. And we say to ourselves, well, how many charge tracks are associated with that vertex? Because typically jets are going to have a lot of charge tracks associated with the vertex, whereas the 4 tau predominantly decay to a 1 charge track event, sometimes 3. So if we just select events with 4 or 6 charge tracks associated with the muon vertex, including the muon, then we should be able to get some rejection against backgrounds. And as you can see, these are all the different types of backgrounds. You do get some rejection. The interesting one from the purpose of the overlap backgrounds is this one here. And you can see a substantially larger number of charge tracks on average. And that basically happens because these overlap backgrounds are built up from normal events at the LHC. Normal events have a lot of underlying events from multiple parts-on-parts and scattering. So that means they have a lot of charge tracks associated with the vertex. And this is a very standard approach now with rejecting these overlap backgrounds. If you want to do a central exclusive analysis, you've got to do something with charge tracks to beat down these overlap backgrounds. In diejet analyses, you can look perpendicular to the diejets, right, and see that there aren't any tracks there. The overlap backgrounds, which are built from inclusive events, will have charge tracks. So again, if you're going to stick in your favourite Higgs model and have a look and see how it decays, you really don't want something that's decaying quite spherically, right? You want to be able to reject some of these charge track properties to a high degree.
Yeah, this is also very dependent on tracking efficiency, right, and the instantaneous luminosity.
Yes. So, another thing that we did in the analysis was we did some, we worked on the topology of the charge track. So this is a 6-track event. What we did is we just clustered the things together to create tau objects. We just stuck these 3 together. That was 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we clustered those together to make pseudo-scalar objects. And we put cuts on all of these variables because typically the charge tracks and diejet events, if you've ended up with just 4 or 6 charge tracks, typically won't be in, it will be all over the place. So we put cuts on them, but they're not very interesting in terms of the beating down of this overlap background. So I'll focus on the point where we get to the 2 pseudo-scalar objects and what we do after that. So the first thing we do is we cut on the delta phi between the 2 pseudo-scalars.
So the reason, how do you define the direction of pseudo-scalar
object? So we just basically, we've got the, for each of the charged tracks, we've got a PT and a pseudo-rapidity and a
because there are neutrinos there, right?
Sorry?
There are neutrinos on each of them, so...
Yeah, so the assumption... Absolutely, yeah. So what we do is we just say that, well, let's pretend for a moment...
So sort of center of gravity of the visible tracks.
What we actually go with is we just say, right, we cluster these two, for example, together, using PT, we PT cluster them together, giving an eta and a phi, that's basically due to how important this one's eta is based on its PT. And of course we've got missing energy, we've got pi's and we've got neutrinos, but the assumption is that these things are quite collinear. These A's are very light from the decay, so they're quite boosted. So the decay products of the A's, we would just make this assumption that they're collinear. Of course, they aren't exactly
collinear. They can be as far as, I think typical they're like 0.5 away from each other, right?
These things?
Yeah.
They're about 0.4.
Yeah. So it's pretty logical. Right?
Yeah. But,
it's really the important question how critical this is on what you get, so maybe it's not important, but certainly you have large uncertainty in determining.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So we don't know the angle, we just PT weight them and say that's the best thing that we can do, right, to get the angles. But so what happens when you do that is you end up with this black curve here is the, for example, the delta phi, right, if you do that PT weighting. And these are the central exclusive backgrounds, which are at this point quite similar, right? These are the ones here. This sort of purpley curve that's extending out down here goes to bigger delta phis. And the reason why that is that to have a back-to-back delta phi, you need no initial state radiation, which is actually is what you have in central exclusive events. You don't have hard initial state radiation, everything goes into the central system. Whereas a diejet event at the LHC has some initial state radiation, it won't have back-to-back phi. We make quite a loose cut on this because it isn't a perfect sort of back-to-back measure because we've lost all of these neutrals. So we just make it bigger than 2.8. But that's the first thing we do. And that's another thing that you do with overlap backgrounds is that you take advantage of the fact that they have can have a large amount of initial state radiation. The second thing that we do, and this is more in line with having these forward detectors, is that you say, right, I've got my, I know what the rapidity of my Higgs was in the first place. So I've clustered my pseudoscalars, and the average rapidity of those two pseudoscalars should give me the rapidity of the Higgs, if I've reconstructed it correctly. So I can compare the two rapidities. This is the rapidity measured by FP420, which I put on the second slide. And this is the average of the two pseudoscalars that I've clustered together. And this is the distribution that you get out at the end. Again, a very peaked distribution for the diffractive events. This is this one here at the bottom. Might look very small at this point. This is just normalized to, these are just normalized to one. So what you get is that this seems to be a straight line coming out, and in fact it carries on for quite a while out here. And the reason why you get this is, remember that the rapidity of the central system that you get from your forward detectors for overlap events is going to have absolutely nothing to do with the power scatter itself. It's basically come from a completely different interaction. The kinematics cannot match up in general. So by cutting on a variable like this, you can reduce the overlap background significantly. And what you could also decide to do if you didn't have so much missing energy would be to cut on the mass of the central system as well. If you have a BB bar system, you can compare the mass of the BB bar to the mass of the forward detectors to remove this background as well. But of course, we've got a lot of missing energy in this case, so we didn't bother trying to impose something like that. Though it turned out later on that we could have done, but it,
how sensitive is this shape on your assumptions on these detectors on the resolution?
Of this here?
Yeah.
At the moment, the resolution of the detector is absolutely not as critical as the breakdown of this collinearity assumption. At the moment, we've assumed that the tracks contain all of the energy of the pseudoscalars. So because we were off...
Well, I'm actually talking about how will you measure the Y from the forward detectors.
Yeah.
How much that gives you, how good the resolution is, and how much it depends on the actual specifications of these detectors. So if your if your position resolution goes down by a factor of 2 or 3, how will this change? That you will not be able to.
I imagine it'll get worse, but I don't know. I don't know how much it changes. It's an equivalent one to how much if your mass resolution got worse in your forward detectors as well, right? So obviously I've shown the mass plots for the resolution. I don't know what the Y resolution is at the moment. Though when we have changed it in the past, but my guess would be that for this particular analysis, the dominant uncertainty for the pseudo rapidity is going to come from this side. Rather than this side, that'll be my guess, but I can't say that it's definitely that because I didn't look at the color. Yeah. okay? In this particular example, it's more important if you have, say, like Higgs to BB bar, you'd be right then, you'd have a, because the Higgs to BB bar central system is going to have all your jet is going to be quite well measured. So then if you have poor uncertainty in this variable, okay. Okay, so you end up with some results at the end when you apply all these cuts. So there's a lot of cuts that I'm putting in there, such as like a mask window around where we're looking for our Higgs and so on. However, I've outlined the ones that are important for the overlap backgrounds, which you'll see in a minute that we've done all right to some degree, but not particularly the best that we could do. The final event rates we present for 3 years of data acquisition at a specific instantaneous luminosity, and we assume that you get 10 inverse femtobarns per year at 10 to the 33, and 100 inverse femtobarns per year at 10 to the 34. And this is a pretty standard assumption in Atlas and CMS at the present, though whether that's in fact how much integrated luminosity you get is to be observed when we turn the LHC on. You clearly will see as well that the signal drops as you go from sort of mid-luminosities up to higher luminosities. And this is basically due to the fact that as you go up in luminosity, you get more and more interactions. And we're asking for 4 or 6 charged tracks associated with a vertex. There's a good chance that a random track from a pile-up event is going to fall in there and wreck our analysis. And that's what's happening. This is just basically dropping because our analysis is less efficient at high luminosity. The background increases really rapidly, right? It would also be affected by this pile-up tracks falling in there as well. But what you're seeing here is that luminosity dependence, the overlap background becoming hugely dominant at high luminosities. And okay, so it looks like we've done quite well, but as you can see, the signal-to-background ratio here is substantially better than it is at high luminosity, and that's just a generic property of these analyses. Having a look at significances.
Sorry, is this optimized for that particular mass and particular scenario, or are these generic cuts? Would you expect the same search to work for the same class of models but for a wider range of parameters? Or?
For the same final state, the. The biggest problem we have is the collinearity. Reconstructing pseudoscalars is just from tracks. So if it's a heavier pseudoscalar, then these things are going to be increasingly further and further apart. But if they're lighter than the 9.7, then they will be closer together, so we will do even better, right? If it's not going to 4 taus, and we're looking at jet final states, then okay, we'll start.
That just meant just for the particular masses, for example, mass of the Higgs, mass of the pseudoscalar. So,
okay, so if you
whether these cuts were somehow optimized for that or
not particularly. Okay, not, yeah. In some, we've only really put on things like charged tracks. We've I said that we clustered the topology thing. That's where we've really just required those tracks on one side that will be from from a pseudoscalar going to 2 taus. The charged tracks are out. We've required them to be within a delta R of 1, so not particularly optimized because it's peaked at 0.4. If the pseudoscalar gets sufficiently heavier, right, well, it might not go to taus anymore, but if it did and still went to taus, then it'd get wider and wider and you start failing analysis. Also, your delta Y cuts then would get worse and worse, but if it gets lighter, then you'd be winning more, I imagine.
Oh, I'm skipping there.
Ahead. So we decided to look at what the significances are for those 3 years of data acquisition as a function of luminosity. If the LHC was stuck at 4 times the 33, what would we see? And I've presented it in terms of the 10 GeV transverse momentum trigger and the 15 GeV transverse momentum trigger. And the left plot is for what I've presented in this talk, that just the muon trigger. And as you can see, this is the black curve here is a 10 GeV. You've just about pop above 3 at a sort of medium luminosity, and then the overlap background comes in and you start losing significance, so you wouldn't be able to do it at high luminosity. The mu 15 slightly gets above 3, but still drops off very fast. You would probably want the lower muon threshold at this point. However, if you manage to improve your timing to reject the overlap background, or if you don't improve your timing, if someone comes up with a better way to reject these types of backgrounds than what we've already thought of, then you get a much higher significance. In the new 10 trigger case, you're above 3 all of the time, regardless of luminosity, though it still starts dropping at high luminosities. On the right, it's exactly the same thing, but for double the data. Now, double the data basically boils down to combining ATLAS and CMS results together, or having a better trigger strategy. Now, we only considered a single muon trigger, but of course there's electron triggers, muon-electron, muon-muon triggers, and a guy from CMS, Dmitry Zabarov, went through this and had a look at the standard CMS triggers and found that we actually underestimated our final signal rates, assuming that they would pass the subsequent cuts by a factor of about 2.5. So this could be, say, ATLAS with just CMS with CMS triggers. And as you can see, now you get significances that can get above 5 and always above 3, regardless of luminosity. But it's always dropping off. This overlap background's always pulling us down. This is something that's always the same in these central exclusive analyses. At the moment, at the highest luminosities, we cannot deal with these amounts of interactions in each point crossing. Though if you improve the timing, then you're above 5 for a large bit of parameter space. So that's the final sort of bit for this analysis, and obviously I would probably wouldn't have shown it here if it had come out with the significance of 1. There are analyses which is aren't as favourable, but this one, primarily due to the lepton triggers, is getting us into a region that's nice. The last thing that I'm just going to mention before I stop is the fact that at the moment I've just said that we've observed something that had tracks and we have got a good mass measurement of our Higgs, but what we'd really like to do is measure both Higgs. We've got Higgs decay to two pseudoscalars. And the question is, at this point we've thrown away a whole load of information on neutrals and so on, can we still get out the pseudoscalar mass? Now, it turns out that our forward proton information then allows us to constrain possible solutions to equations. And so basically, for momentum conservation, the two pseudoscalars have to add up to the Higgs mass. If you then say that, use this collinearity approximation again, say that the neutrals that we've missed are were decayed along the same direction as the original pseudoscalar, then you can basically say that the visible momentum from one pseudoscalar is each component is just a fraction of the original pseudoscalar momentum. And then what you can do is that you can basically what you say is that you need your longitudinal momentum of the A and the A2 to be the longitudinal momentum of the Higgs. Well, we know what the longitudinal momentum of the Higgs has got to be from our forward proton measurements. And the X and Y components, remember we had zero angle scattering, so a good approximation, so it's probably going to be zero. So basically you can solve these equations, you've got two equations here, you can solve these against each other to get four independent pseudoscalar mass measurements for each event. And if you do that, then you find that the one on the left is just the distribution from like zillions of these events. And you see that it's quite broad, though peaked in about in the region where you'd like it to be. The reason why it's broad is not due to detector resolution. You can make the detector resolution on the tracks an order of magnitude worse before you even start really affecting this shape. This is due to the breakdown of the collinearity approximation. These things didn't decay along the directions of the A's, but they did do quite well. And then the one on the right is what you'd expect for 150 inverse picobars of data collected at our medium luminosity, which was optimal. And you can see that you've got a few events that peak in the right area. Of course, this is just a guess at what you'd expect to get a completely different distribution from a different set of. This is like pseudo data what we might get. So if you examine these a lot of these different ones, then you get you pretty much get a mass measurement that's undercutting slightly from the 9.7 that we'd expect. But there's a 2.3 GeV systematic on the A mass measurement. And this is sort of reassuringly close to what we'd be able to measure. So
that's uncertainty on the central value that you extract
from
each,
many of the
pseudo measurement.
Yeah, so it's a sort of like.
But the uncertainty itself is probably larger, right? Looking at this. If
yeah.
you were to fit this somehow, what would be your measurement from this sample plot? If you were asked what is the mass of the pseudo scalar based on the plot on the right,
yeah,
so it would be.
Well, you probably have what?
Nine something plus or minus.
So like it's four at worst, say, right? But then you've got 24 events, so it'll be what the statistical one there would be 4 over root 24, so less than a GeV. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's true. I think this is just a systematic, though it's probably smaller than the statistical probably is smaller than the systematic. Well, it's right, yeah, this is just a systematic. So maybe 2.8, I'll amend my slide. So basically it worked well in this particular analysis, obviously I wouldn't have shown it otherwise. So Higgs to Fuller Tau in this particular scenario worked brilliantly as long as we have these four detectors. It's not always the case, sometimes you just can't beat down the overlap background even at low luminosities. So what you really, the important...
Ask about, you know, this... thing, you just added all four, this mass is just, on that distribution, you're just showing all of these different ways of determining the mass, right? Some of them which really use your forward detectors, other pieces of information are just coming from this, you know, central reconstruction, assuming that the neutrals are going in the same direction as the charged tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, it would seem like those have very different, you know, uncertainties and so on, so I'm just kind of surprised that you just kind of lumped them all together like this. Is that... They really have all
well, but
roughly
all
the
them,
same width.
All of them have contributions from each of these, right? It's just, you know, they're weighted differently.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like you can pick one measurement that relies only on
but he has four independent ones, so... Okay.
In principle, they should all agree, but of course, because of the lack of collinear...
Yeah, the biggest one's that.
So if you throw away the collinear assumption, then you don't have any mass determination?
Not for the A mass, but for the
not
Higgs
for
mass.
The A mass. For the Higgs mass, you have this purely forward thing.
Yeah, right. Well, actually, you can also plot the Higgs mass gets determined by this also, but of course, the distribution is much broader than what you get from
right.
the forward proton, so it's not useful. But it also agrees with
yeah,
your
agrees.
Central value that you
yeah.
know is there. So.
Okay. Thanks.
So yeah, the this one works, others don't. Maybe the thing to sort of take away is that if you've got a large enough cross section, as I said, these are low, but if you have something that isn't gluophobic that you wanted to study in this way and you think that you might have a way to trigger on it, then that's kind of key. Or you can persuade people to work out how to trigger on it for you, then you've got a quantum number measurement of your central resonance, and you've also got a mass measurement to very, very high precision. So that's always nice. So when we did this, we were told that it was very hard to find this at the LHC, and so difficult decay channels where you might not think that your non-standard Higgs circuit could be found become possible using forward detectors. However, there are some outstanding experimental things. I skipped the trigger by using something that decayed nicely to leptons. That's how we got around it that way. If you're looking for Higgs to be B-bar, then the jet or Higgs to jet, then you're really going to have to find some way of getting that past your trigger with, you know, a good amount of efficiency. Though the Higgs to 4B, the thing that was said before, the trigger was 30%. You know, that could be possible with this. 30% is quite high. And then finally, the time of flight rejection is good. It brings down these overlap backgrounds. We can use things like the fact that the overlap backgrounds are underlying events to reduce them, but at high luminosity we're still not anywhere near getting rid of them to the same level of getting rid of our other backgrounds. So any ideas in how to get rid of these, or perhaps you know how to build a 1 picosecond timing system, that would be good news for us.
You hadn't told me about the CMS statement before. The underestimated the trigger efficiency by 2.5. Did I remember right from your...
Yeah.
Do you believe what they're telling you, or?
Yeah, I got them to send me their notes, which is not even public yet, so it's not really allowed because I'm an Atlas. But
oh, I see.
The reason why I didn't know about it is because it's still buried in their system of reviewing these things. But yeah, well, I just went with the easiest thing that I could think of, which was the RPT new one. However, we gave them the Monte Carlo hack that we did, and because they were interested in it, and the questions that were put to us, because we were sort of getting through the analysis, we said, how can we contribute to this? And I said, well, find out whether these charge track efficiencies are realistic, and find out if there's a better way to trigger. So they did the second one first and found out there is a better way to trigger, and that's really, really good news. I'm hoping to come back with the charge track efficiencies are up there, though of course that's it's a much harder thing to work out. Well, that's going to be like, the luminosity dependent, it's going to be obvious that...
Wait, Jack, are you saying that this is with regard to the plot that was about the combined Atlas CMS sensitivities?
Yeah, right. That doesn't include that. That's just using the muon, the mu 10 or whatever trigger efficiency. I mean, CMS is now telling Andrew and that actually that's underestimated. Like 2.5, the efficiency is 2.5.
How is it? Can you explain how is it underestimated? Because of...
We only,
you
we
want
said
to
we,
use a different trigger, or?
We said all we wanted in our final event was a muon above the trigger threshold, and then we just took 80% of those events to map out the turn-on curve of the trigger threshold. Of course, we're missing out all the electron decays. If you have two muons in your final event, then you've got a lower trigger threshold, you got electron-muon triggers, and in fact, a few of them even pass the TAL triggers. And
so effectively, you're talking about just using other triggers except the inclusive muon one.
We didn't take that into account, which was obviously it didn't occur to me at the time that it could be as large in efficiency as a factor of 2.5. What really surprised me was is that these things each of these TAUs has an energy of about say 20 odd GeV, and then you're losing a neutrino when it decays, and which is sort of maybe say nominally a half, so you've got like maybe 11 GeV worth of hadronic energy, it's sort of the hadronic decay, and it turns out that somehow these things are actually maybe passing some of the tau threshold as well. It's not a big efficiency there, but there was some efficiency. I thought it would be none, but
much efficiency from the tau triggers, I'm pretty sure. But
it's small, but I was amazed that there was any. I mean,
but if you looked at the what the official trigger table is, we have like dimuons with 3 GeV. So if you have two muons with 3 GeV each, it's already there.
Yeah, that's the one that came back with quite a few. Then the single electron was, can't remember what that was at. I think single muon was at 14 GeV, and single electron's a bit higher.
Single muon, if it's isolated, it's 11 GeV. At least for, it's for initial running, there was for 10 to 30.
This nice line, right?
Yeah.
Presumably it's...
Yeah. It's at a low luminosity, then... I mean, all right, because so we... If you decide that the significance was exactly signal over root background, right, then at low luminosity, it's the central exclusive backgrounds that are the dominant ones, so you'd say it was a factor of 1.4. If it, for a factor of 2, discrepancy in production, it'd be a factor of 1.4. At high luminosity, it's overlap, which is the dominant one, so it's going to be a factor of 2.
Do we have any measurements of these types of events, say with the factor of 2, the factor of 1, in the self rather than models, or in inverters?
Yeah. So we have a...
You asked the right question.
Well done. There is some stuff that's come out of the Tetratron. Right, on specifically this process, this central exclusive process. And so what they did was is they looked in a sample called the double Pomeran exchange sample, which is essentially you have two forward protons, you've got and but each one is sort of offering up a pom run, right, in a way during the collision now. So this is going back to sort of the 60s and Reggie theory, but you take a part and out of the pom run and collide them together, and so there's pom run remnants left over in the central system. So you've got something that looks like this, proton, some sort of colour singlet exchange.
Can you go
to
the next page and then write a little higher?
Yeah. I'll use two things. Okay. So you've got a... two protons which remain intact. There's some sort of, this is a sort of generic colour singlet exchange here, which is a pomeron. You take a blue one from each pomeron, you've got your diject. But necessarily, because these things were colour singlet when they were sort of offered up, you've got some sort of pomeron remnant activity left over. So what CDF did is he took the mass of this and compared it to the mass of everything, and said, what distribution does that look like? And this is the, so the red crosses there are the data for this RJJ distribution, which is just this divided by this. And so buried in this sample, you'd expect the central exclusive event, which you'd expect that the mass of the central exclusive events, because you don't have this, would be, you'd expect the RJJ to be equal to one. And that's, you get some sort of out of cone corrections and stuff to that. So what they did was that they took fits to the sort of PDFs of double pomeron exchange from HERA, and they applied it at the Tevatron, and they found that you have this excess of events at a large RJJ where you'd expect the central exclusive events to be. And they said, well, this is a sort of a hint towards something being there. They also changed the PDFs to make sure that the uncertainty couldn't bend it up there and so on. And they said that they found, I think this is a six sigma effect. And then what they did was is that this is the Monte Carlo that we use for the analysis, which is what people generally tend to use. And they did this as for a function of ET of each jet, and then said, well, how does that change with the distribution? This is the the data with the default prediction over the top of it. So.
They're seeing both
protons. Well, actually, they only see one proton. We've got one forward proton detector. So it's actually the antiproton.
So in that second plot, that's the prediction is the dotted line, and then the dots are the experimental measurement as a function of the invariant mass of what you believe to be the diffractive production.
Just know that the so what they did is they took out what this excess is. They just subtracted this excess.
So since that's a log plot, and now we're getting up to sort of like 100 to 130 GeV range, which is so okay. I know it's CDF, it's a different experiment, but a different energy range entirely. But at high energy, it looks like you're starting to miss by a factor of what is that?
Okay, so I should also add another piece of information, which I usually. Don't tell people. Is that I agree completely. There is a problem here, but these are the shape of this depends on the PDF that you put in, right? And for a start, so you can change the shape of it slightly, but that's not really very this is a sort of MJJ region that we may be interested in, and it is slightly a concern that this is missing until you find out that this version of the Monte Carlo that we used had a bug in it for the diject production, which overestimated the diject production by a factor of two. So actually, it seems at this point might be all right, but these ones no longer agree.
There's also the gamma-gamma final state they looked at too.
Yeah, so they looked at central exclusive just diphoton production through a quark box, and they observed two events that they said were consistent with it being central exclusive diphoton production. The problem is that no one really knows how to work out what pi-pi production would be. So central exclusive pi-pi production is too hard to calculate. So they were consistent, these two events, with it being both being central exclusive events. In fact, I think the prediction was a factor of two higher, right? And the observable events, were a factor of two higher than the predicted value, but of course there's only two events, so it could be statistically fluctuate anywhere at that point. And also it could be pions in there. So
as an outsider, if I was being cynical, I'd look at this and say, well, okay, this shows you that you're in a very hard situation, not exquisite theoretical control, and you know, here you have a living example of something where you just don't really know what to conclude, it looks like. So I'm just wondering, what would you conclude from this? I mean, you don't understand forward product forward jets, or what do you think?
I think there's some work needs to be done theoretically, but there is a factor of two uncertainty in that, right, which is built in from the PDS. I mean, that this needs to be better understood. None of this is attempted to be tuned or anything
but,
like that.
But is the sense that that's the uncertainty that we should be talking about here, that it's a factor of two uncertainty, it's not like a factor of 10 uncertainty?
It's a factor of 2 to 3 is what most people put forward now as the uncertainty in the calculation. And that basically comes from not very good knowledge of the unintegrated PDFs, and also when you have these two processes interacting, for the proton to remain intact, you don't want these spectator partons to interact with each other and produce underlying events, so it's the probability that that doesn't happen. And that soft survival probability, there's about 3 different models have all converged to within sort of 50 to 75% error as well, so it's factor of 2.5 to 3, theoretical uncertainty. But the first thing that you really should do with the LHC is pin down, using early data measurements without forward protons, you can pin down unintegrated PDF uncertainty, so you will know exactly where you are in the PDF range and the soft survival factors as well. But
getting back to your Higgs challenge, would it help to go to single refractive rather than double when the cross section go up a lot, and you still know something about how much energy lost from
that? You wouldn't have a good mass measurement at the end. You would have a higher cross section. Though I expect that the overlap background is spectacularly large at that point, because you haven't got any timing information at all at that point. You use differences in timing to go back. So your mass measurement wouldn't be good. I mean, so you could think about doing something, but it might be difficult.
I have a generic question. So is this considered the most promising way to look for Higgs proportional? Like is it really that much more advantageous to go to this and lose 1,000 and then a factor of 1,000 in the cross section? Compared to vector building.
Well, I don't think we know the answer, you know. I mean, there are several groups within, you know, Lipotenko and company are working on the 4-tau.
I see, so
it's not WW fusion. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
So I would think that would be a pretty viable way to proceed if they follow this track-based approach. But once again, you want to use the fact that you have a color singlet business going on, so it should be a quiet event, and count the number of tracks that could be associated with the Higgs, and you know everything else in that general central region. I would think that would be pretty effective.
Well, the nice thing about this, right, is that it doesn't even matter necessarily. I mean, of course, it's great if it's 4-tau, and then you can actually do the mass reconstruction that we're talking about, but you can, by just doing the protons, you can get the Higgs, right? I mean, you have sensitivity even if it turns out not to be 4-tau.
Right.
So.
Except the trigger, there's trigger issue. How do you trigger?
There's a
trigger. Okay. Well, if it's not 4-tau, die jet background start getting a little bit more interesting.
That's the big issue if you had something other than the count.
You have to look and see what the efficiency goal is your favorite model. Okay.
Exactly.
It's absolutely not model independent. It's the opposite.
I mean, if somehow they could open it, is there any hope that they could open up the window for keeping the event? I mean, what would that involve?
I think it would require, first, the biggest problem that you have is, I think it's the pipelines of the inner detector are significantly below the sort of 4 microseconds which you'd like. I mean, so basically you're limited. You could envisage updating all the trigger readouts and so on, but if the pipelines
are
longer.
Are you talking about putting the requirement on the forward detectors into the trigger?
Yeah, so then you could have, I mean, so even at high luminosity, you would have a factor of like 100 to 150 rejection over non-diffractive events. So it'd be great.
You guys will have to bring, you know, a few million bucks.
Take all those events that you're throwing away and just give them, just throw pipe them down the beam to you guys. That's what you need. You can throw them away, you know.
We need either a significant overhaul of Atlas or CMS or someone to change the speed of light.
Wasn't there a proposal to have one to 200 Olson? Would that be close enough?
Yes, so 200 you can trigger on.
Yeah, that's not $1 million.
For a Higgs mass of 100, that doesn't have any acceptance.
I see.
That's the
you can't get close enough.
Yeah, the other problem is that you can't. It's the fact that every time you ask for a proton hit, you reduce the non-diffractive the ones that would pass the trigger. So only asking for one at higher luminosity doesn't really get very far as well. But so it's just great.
Does it put some sort of a trigger type detector near the beam, but not quite as far away as your detector? Would that conceivably help? So in other words, you're not trying to make a quality measurement with it, but you're trying to make a trigger for possible diffractive events.
The only thing is it has to be in one of the large dispersion regions at the LHC, because you need it to come out of the beam and then go and be tagged and then go back into the beam, and then when we measure it, then measure it as 420 meters. So the only place where I know that happens at the moment is 220 meters. So.
I guess at CDF they put their detector actually into the beam pipe, right? Or something like that.
Another question I was going to ask maybe related to this is just, there's TOTEM, right, which is, and isn't that somehow, that doesn't require you to take the particles out of the beam or so on, does it?
Yeah, so the ones that have lost momentum come out of the beam, where TOTEM is in the large dispersion region, it's 20 meters, in principle, like, there actually is acceptance, possibly, at 100 GeV. But it turns out that if you put detectors at 200 meters, units mix up there. But if you put them there, then there's a dead window at the edge here. And so protons that would come through this region and then be put back into the beam and then come out at 420 meters basically just get, they disintegrate with interaction with the edge, dead region of the detector. So it attenuates the signal at 420 meters. Then there's the ones where they tagged it both. So you've got that problem. But you could say, I think that something like, you might be able to get 30% of these if you optimize them, get them in with a 220 meter detector and to tag one of the protons. So that would improve your rate. Obviously in this analysis, it's not particularly that important. But if you're looking at, say, Higgs to 4b, maybe slightly higher mass, 110, right, then you might start thinking that 220 meter tags have your, maybe keeping up if you can, especially in conjunction with the fact that you might have a very low PT neuron trigger in conjunction with that. So.
Any other questions?
Comments? Okay, let's thank Andrew. I don't even know where we are on our schedule. This is where we're supposed to be, and
Higgs divisible plus missing energy.
Higgs divisible plus missing energy, and it's 3:10.
We're 5 minutes ahead.
Okay, so that's fine. All right, so then we'll. So let me just. I want to make a phone call to the restaurant. Is there anybody who didn't raise their hand or tell me who wants to come to dinner at 7:00 tonight? You coming? Two more? Okay. Jack, are you coming?
I just don't know.
I don't know yet?
I talked to my wife.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So let's have, Spencer, are you ready to go?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so why don't
is
you
he
just
using his computer? Okay, let me retrieve my device here before I forget.
Actually, could I keep it for the rest of the day and give it to you tomorrow? I won't lose it. I've got like 3 of those at home. So.
All right. Well, now I only have one.
Okay, I'll give you this one.
Here.
Okay.